Hello, and welcome to Torah in Motion's MP3 audio library. We hope you enjoy this recording of a live Torah in Motion presentation. For more information, please visit www.torahinmotion.org. Thank you.
The first story is what Tisha B'Av is all about. The story of the Meraglim. We don't have to review the stories. And Chazal, our rabbis, when they look into the issue of what went wrong with the story of the spies, so Rashi brings us from Chazal that the spies were concerned that should the Jewish people enter the land of Israel, that these people who were the tribal leaders and great tzaddikim, they understood that when the Jewish people will now leave the desert environment and move into Eretz Yisrael, they will no longer suit the criteria necessary to become the leaders of their tribes. And because they would lose that position of being the leader, it suited them much more to encourage the Jewish people to remain in Egypt. And that is why they gave all the reports that they said, saying the land is so difficult, we won't be able to conquer the land, and etc., etc. Eretz Ocheles Yoshveha. Yes, you know, we're not worthy. All the different drushes, I'm sure you've heard on this. But Chazal, they just seem to come out of nowhere and come up with a reason that you don't see anywhere in the text. Well, they didn't want to lose their jobs. So you got to stop and think, what right do the rabbis have to make such a critical comment about such tzaddikim when the text doesn't seem to suggest that? But you see that our rabbis do this quite often, especially in the book of Bamidbor. We find a little bit before and a little bit after similar types of stories where Chazal seem to take great liberties in figuring out the motives of people that are very far from what the simple text would suggest. We know in the parsha before, when the Jewish people were complaining about the manna, they weren't happy with it. They said, oh, if we could only have that fish that we had for free in Egypt, if we could only have some of those leeks and melons and onions and garlic. Oh, if we could have that, oh, geschmack, if we could have a deli somewhere around the corner. And we are told that they were boche lemishpachosam. They were crying to their families about the menu list, whatever you want to call it. And the rabbis say, what were they really complaining about? What they really were complaining about was, and therefore challenging Moshe and Aaron's authority through that, they were complaining because once they got the Torah, previous relationships, close relationships that were permitted, the Torah disallowed. And they were extremely upset that they couldn't have these intimate relationships with intimate people that they knew. And that was the real reason why they were upset about the month. Again, okay, the rabbis can play license with the words. I mean, the text kind of hints to it. They're crying to their families about family life. Okay, you know, maybe they have a poetic license for this, but where's their moral license to go indict the Jewish people for such things? And finally, we find by Korach, the famous story with Korach, where Korach is representing equality for all men, we're all Kedoshim, we're all holy people, and the whole story that happened with Korach. And Rashi comments, Korach pikeach hoya. Korach was a very smart man. Ma ra laso shtus keela. What did he see that brought him to such shtus, such foolishness? So we were told that the Rashi says there were a number of political appointments made, Moshe and Aaron. So Moshe got the top job, he gave his brother the next job, then comes the job of being the Nasi of Shevet Levi, and he thought for sure he's the next one in line, He's the brightest person around, the richest person around, the biggest tzaddik, indeed, which he was. And when he found that that appointment went to someone else, who came younger in the family line, so to speak, that he couldn't tolerate anymore. That was ignored, couldn't live with that anymore. And therefore, what happened? He started the whole revolution. So here we've got three examples where you look at the story and it appears to be one way. The spies are saying, oh, we wish we could come into the land, but we can't do it. And we could peg them with a number of faults. Lack of bitachon, etc. But what do we peg them with? They're afraid they're going to lose their job. We have people complaining about the manna. They'd like to have different menu. And the rabbis say, no, that's not what it is. They really are a bunch of immoral people. And then we have Korach, who's preaching equality, which seems to be a reasonable thing. Okay, you could say, all kinds of things, but to say that he was jealous, that he didn't get an appointment for such an intelligent... Where did the rabbis have license to come up with this? Where do they get that tip-off that lets them say this? So the answer is, if you look in Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's work on the Torah, and he says it more regarding Lot, but we'll stay away from that. Rabbi Yaakov says that just like we know that the Torah is filled with pardes, the Torah is called an orchard because there's multi-levels to the understanding of Torah. We have the pei, we have the pshat. You look at the pasuk and you see what the words say. Then you've got the remez, then you've got the hints. There's an extra hay over there, a word missing, something there. Then we have the drush, where the midrash tells us much more than what we thought was going on. And then we have the samach, the sod, which is the depths of what the real essence of what's going on. And this multi-layers of understanding Chumash. So just like the Torah is a pardes, and the Torah is like an onion almost, that you can peel it, and you see something on the surface, and you peel a little more, you see a little more, you peel a little more, till you come to the depths. So says Rabbi Yaakov, guess what? Not only is the Torah pardes, but since we know that the Jewish people and Hashem and the Torah are one, so the Jewish people have the same quality. And the Jewish people, every human being for that matter, is his own pardes. Every human being has the pshat. You see what he tells everybody. But then if you look carefully, you'll see some remuzim. You'll see a little hint, a few hints. And then you'll see that there's another layer beneath that. There's a little drush. And you go a little deeper, you're going to find the real sod. If you look deep enough, you'll find what's driving all the behavior that's going on. And almost always, things never appear as, they never are as they really appear. And Chazal understood this. They understood that's how we learn Torah, and that's how we have to understand people. So what was going on that gave the rabbis the license to peel away? So let's look at all these stories, and obviously the lessons will be very powerful for us. The spies. Now let's take everything into perspective here. The Almighty said what? The land is very, very good. The Almighty said. The Almighty said, I want you to go in, and I want you to conquer the land. The Almighty says, you're going to be able to do it. I mean, why did I take you out of Egypt if not for this purpose? They see the Almighty has a pretty good track record. You know, he took the most powerful nation in the world. Egypt was clearly the most powerful nation in the world. And he obliterated them, totally. And it wasn't even like a Shiloh what he meant with them. And the whole world is trembling. Okay, how's his track record? Not bad, not bad. Comes along the spies. And they now see what's going on in Eretz Yisrael. They see, unbelievable, it's a beautiful land, just like Hashem said. Oh, but there's giants over there. It's giants. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be very difficult. Yes, it's like God promised, but we're not going to be able to do it. Now, any rational person, now we're not talking that Moshe sent a bunch of schleppers. guys who aren't connected to spirituality, who, you know, can be open to these kinds of things. And, you know, a schlepper without a Torah perspective could say anything. And, you know, of course you could expect this. But these are tzaddikim. These are people who were willing. Why were they the leaders of their tribe? They were willing to take the lash on their back as they were the taskmasters in Egypt so that their brethren wouldn't have to take it. That's why they were the leaders. They were unbelievable people. They were tzaddikim. They knew Torah. They understood Hashem. So now would come along an amazing rabbi, and we get up after giving a whole drush on what Hashem did in Yetzias Mitzrayim and everything that happened. And he's going to say, you know what? I don't think we can do it now. You got to be out of your mind. This isn't like, well, maybe they're just a little off. Maybe they made a little miscalculation over here. After everything Hashem did for them, and everything, and they understood what the direction was. It's what Hashem told Avram Avinu at the covenant between the parts. It's what Hashem told Klal Yisrael before He gave them the Torah. After He forgave them for the sin of the golden calf. Even if you do such averus, I can still forgive you. Now it's time to move along. And everything Hashem did to show them, I want to hasten the process and let's move it along. And now they come with the most bizarre rationale and saying, we can't take the land. Well, maybe anything else you could have said was true, but that is the most obtuse argument that they could have come up with. And when the rabbis see that they're talking nonsensically, that's a tip-off that that's only a cover-up for something altogether different. There's got to be something much more than meets the eye for a person to act that way. And therefore, the rabbis understood there's only one rationale for a leader not wanting the people to get into the land because they're afraid they won't be the leaders anymore. The same thing with the manna. People are complaining about the manna. Now, what are they complaining about? I mean, I wish we had manna. Can you imagine if we had manna? I wouldn't have to schlep to Sobeys. First, you schlep to Sobeys for an hour and a half, and of course, then you have to go to No Frills to get the cheaper items that Sobeys doesn't, right? So you got to spend an hour and a half, 2 hours doing that. It's very good. Husbands, if you don't shop, you should go with your wife once on a date and shop with her to really know what she does. Because it's incredible. It's incredible. 2 hours shopping, and you're taking food and putting it in the basket. If you really think about it, it's really putting food in the basket just to take it out of the basket, on the cart, to just put it back into the basket, and then take it to your car to put it back into the car, and every time you got to figure out the eggs on the top, the eggs on the bottom, this on the top, the heavy stuff, and then finally to take it back into your house. Too much time is involved in just getting the food into the house. We haven't even started talking about putting it now into the pantry, and then from the pantry into the kitchen, and then to cook it, and everything else, and then the serving, and then the eating, and then the cleaning, and then the dishes, and then this and that. And guess what? You get to start it all over next Wednesday. And that's lucky if your wife or husband is a good cook. What if they're not such a good cook? You know, sometimes the cholent doesn't come out, right? Sometimes the challah, you forget to put the sugar in it. It doesn't, you know. And after all said and done, you still have to say, that's a wonderful meal, dear. And now you got the opportunity. It just comes from the heaven. Whatever you want, it'll taste whatever you want. Right? Can you imagine the housewives were thrilled? Right? And we don't want to talk about the other part that after you eat, where the food has to go and all that other stuff with plumbing and all these other issues. And we know the miracle of a man is you didn't even have to worry about those things. There was no problems. It was pure food. Can you imagine you have such a diet? And what are you going to say? What's the best you could say? You say, listen, you know, really that fish in Egypt. Now that was free. What fish for free? What did you have in Egypt? Some leeks and melons and onions and garlic? Is that what you're complaining about? You manage to go to a fancy restaurant. You go to, I don't know the names of the fancy restaurants now. Say, how was the meal? Well, you know, they didn't have garlic. You know, like, come on. So obviously the rabbi said, this wasn't the problem. This could not be the problem. It's the best food you could want in the world. So if they're so critical about something, and it's like you're way off base, there's got to be something much deeper. And it's everything that the manna represented. It represented a higher level of kedusha in a human being. And it meant you have to be separated from certain things. And it meant really you can't have relationships with people that you want. And that was the core problem that they had. And finally with Korach. Korach, as smart as he was, but one thing everybody knew, Moshe was a tzaddik. He's an unbelievable tzaddik. Nobody could come close to Moshe. Moshe was the humblest person, the biggest tzaddik, him and Aaron, Oev Shalom, Rodev Shalom. He's up on the mountain for 40 days. He sticks his neck out to save the Jewish people time and time again. Would you think Hashem gives him the good housekeeping seal of approval and says in front of the whole nation, he's my prophet. Okay, you need any more proof? And now you got the smartest man around, Carson, not so fast. We're going to have to take this for a vote. We have to have some discussions. And I think Moshe's really, you know, doing his own partying, lobbying over here. What, are you crazy? This is Moshe Rabbeinu here. This isn't the chairman of any political party. So Chazal knew if he is complaining about Moshe's integrity and Aaron's integrity, that means there's something much deeper going on. He's plain old-fashioned jealous. And that's, with this yesod of Rabbi Yaakov, we begin to appreciate, and since the Meraglim is Tisha B'Av, and all the stories in front and behind, the whole idea in the desert, you know, the desert is a place where the one thing you got to worry about in the desert, the greatest threat to you is seeing a mirage. And these are the mirages that people were seeing. Unbelievable mirages. Unbelievable mirage that I'm going to lose my job. Unbelievable mirage that I'm going to not have the relationships I want to have with certain people. Or why didn't I get my jealousy? Though why didn't I get the best job? And the Torah is telling us that we have to be oh so careful about hidden agendas. And as we peel away the pardes, what's really going on? But what's most frightening, as we will see, is that quite often the people themselves don't even realize the agendas that they have. But if Tisha B'Av is the day where we suffer because of what the Meraglim did, that means each and every one of us has to deal with these very same issues. These very same issues of agendas, hidden agendas that are within our lives, the deepest layers within the onion of the human being's consciousness. We say certain things and do certain things, but really it's not that way. That's what we have to deal with. That's what the Gemara in Gittin says. Over Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the temple was destroyed, which we'll see fits into this pattern as well. How careful we have to be about hidden agendas. So to understand this a little bit deeper, we'll take a little Hasidic turn into the world of the Piazetzna Rebbe, Rav Klanimus Kalman Shapiro Hashem Yinachem Domov, who's an unbelievable Hasidic master who was killed by the Germans in World War II. He wrote a diary that he called Sav Vizerus, where he wrote his own spiritual challenges. Incredible book. And it could be initially, maybe he never planned on sharing it with people, but we know right before the camp he was liquidated from, in the ghetto he was liquidated from, he put a little letter, he hid it in a metal flask, big container, put a little note saying he wants whoever finds it to publish his mamish miracles how it was found. And in English you can maybe still get the book, it's called To Heal the Soul. And in his 33rd Torah, and I'll read it from the English a bit, I think he really illuminates, he's an unbelievable psychologist, the Piazetzna Rebbe. And let's read a few words and integrate what he says and how it applies to all these stories and then how it applies to us. He calls this psychotic thinking. Now, that's how the English translates it. Now, please don't make a mistake. We're not talking about the psychotic like you talk about in the medical journals. Okay, we're not talking about that kind of psychosis. I think we call the class spiritual psychosis. Okay, but you'll see what he means. He asks a question. Why are we so amazed by the fantasy thoughts of a psychotic, and this is a real psychotic, wondering how such craziness enters the human mind? If you look at a real psychotic person, who one minute is this way, and the next minute is that way, Jekyll and Hyde, we look at it and go, how could that be? Right? We said, and we say, the answer is, taka mishuga, right? It's a mishuga, right? So we wonder how people could be mishuga, right? Then he says, why are we not equally amazed by our own delusions, which are sometimes no less than the psychotics? What the Rebbe in his classic style is saying, you know, you look around the world and you see real psychotic people and you wonder, Nebuch, what's with these people? And the Rebbe says, why don't we look at ourselves and maybe wonder that perhaps we are a bit psychotic ourselves? And he goes on and explains, he says, this is because each of us has one or several emotional weak points. Now, that's the English for the Hasidic terminology, which is a mida nefula. A mida nefula. I'll explain that. Where we still have not matured. Let's explain for a minute what we mean by a mida nefula. Literally, it means a characteristic that has fallen. And Hasidus teaches us a very important rule. Whatever behavior that you see, and maybe especially, if it is negative, all behavior is rooted in Kedusha, is rooted in holiness. However, sometimes the holiness that we should be using, we don't use in the way it should be used, but that mida, that characteristic, still has to be used. And if it isn't used in the place where it should be directed, then the mida, the characteristic, falls. And it falls into a place where it should not go. For example, let's talk about the mida of ahava, of love. It's a pure and holy, it's a characteristic of Hashem that He put into each and every one of us, to love people. And certainly, all love that comes in the world comes from this holy source of the midas ha-chesed. And of course, this love should find a home for itself in Kiddush, in holy things. You should use this mida to love your spouse, to love your children, to love Hashem, to love Torah, to love Eretz Yisrael, to love people who have hurt your feelings. And that's why God gave you this quality, to use this mida in the place where it's so appropriate. And each and every one of our neshamas has a tremendous need to express love. However, if we don't use it in the right places, the Rebbe says, don't think it just sits in neutral. The characteristic is inside of us. The characteristic, like our neshamas, are dying to be expressed. And there's no such thing as saying, well, I'm not going to love anybody, and I'm not going to worry about it, but I'll just be a neutral. The midos that are inside of us do not allow us to remain neutral. And if that mida of ahava, let's say, love, is not given vent and expression in the right way, it must express itself, if you like it or not. And it will express itself in the ugliest places. It will express itself with loving the terrorists who never have lots of trouble finding autonomy and a way to manage their lives. It'll express itself with the cute secretary that works in your office. It will express itself with all kinds of things you should never be loving. Loving food beyond normalcy. But it's going to make a place. It's going to find a place. There's no such thing as holding a mida static. And with the Rebbe, he goes and he says, just like we know there's a concept, we know kishem, just like you get a reward, if you're tempted to do something and you don't do something, you get rewarded for that. Right? You know that principle. That principle already knows. No, you get a reward. If you're thinking of doing everything, you stop yourself, you get a reward for that. The Rebbe does the flip. He says, if a mitzvah comes your way and you don't do it, or an opportunity comes your way and you're passive, it's like you do all kinds of averus. Why does he say that? He says, because if you're not using your meat in the right way, if you like it or not, if you're conscious of it or not, it is going to express itself in the wrong way. So when a person does any avera that you do, it is a distortion of the meat that you have The Midah has fallen out of the place where it is supposed to be. And that natural holy energy that should be directed in a good place, in a holy way, is directed into a bad place. And a person, let's say, who doesn't use chesed in the right way, can act like a Yishmael and use chesed in the wrong way. Which we know that ahava nefula, with love, isn't expressed in the right way, it's expressed in the wrong way. So you know what? I love myself. And whatever I want, I take, and I don't ask. And that's also love. But it's a distortion of that love. This is a very important yesod in Yiddishkeit that unfortunately many secular therapists haven't gotten. See, there's a lot of science to therapy, and they may do a fair amount of work with non-Jews. But see, there's a problem with Jews. There's a factor that therapists haven't figured in yet, and that's called a neshama. It's called a neshama. It's called the midas of Hashem. And if a therapist would have to deal with somebody who loves the wrong things, the secular therapist might try to say, you know what our plan to rehabilitate is? Let's just take away him loving things. Let's cut the love and get it out. But a tzaddik or a Jewish therapist isn't going to remove chesed from that person, but they're going to teach that person, you've got unbelievable chesed. If the guy sees he's been fooling around with a secretary, or he can't stop eating, buzzword, chesed nefula. His strength, his koyach, is chesed. Now, let's not throttle the chesed. Let's just re-channel it to the way that Hashem initially wanted that chesed to go. And let's get him involved in real, good old-fashioned chesed projects that will resonate within his neshama. This is the concept of midah nefula. And the Rebbe says, we all suffer from this. And he says, back to the Rebbe, where we have not yet matured, such as self-indulgence, which is ahava nefula, which is love fallen into the wrong place, love that's distorted, results in tava, results in lust. Instead of you giving to others, you give to yourself. You love yourself. Temper tantrums, which is gvura nefula. Gvura nefula, where one should have self-control, and the opposite, they can run into jealousy, which quite often is the results in temper tantrums. And finally, ego pride. The midah nefula of ego pride, which is tiferes nefula. The attribute of mercy, of synthesizing chesed and gvura, which rears its ugly head in wanting kavod, in wanting honor. Says the Rebbe, whatever it is, each one of us in that area has such irrational thoughts that only a born psychotic could entertain them. But we, sophisticated savants that we are, who become enraged at the slightest affront to our intelligence, are unaware of our own fantasy thoughts, and entertain psychotic thinking. Now here when he's saying psychotic, he doesn't mean the medical psychotic. But he means the spiritual psychotic. Rabbi Nachman tells a story that there was a minister in the kingdom. And the minister in the kingdom finds out that the grain that the kingdom was using had a certain poison in it. And that poison was causing that anyone who would eat from that grain would make them crazy. Would make them crazy. So he rushes to the king and says, Your Highness, we have a major problem. Everybody's been eating the wheat and everybody's gone crazy. So the king says, Have you eaten any? No, I haven't eaten any yet. Have I eaten any yet? No, I haven't eaten any yet. And the advisor, the minister says, And I think it's a good idea that we shouldn't eat them. The king, as wise as he was, he said, You know what, I have to disagree with you. We're going to have to eat the grain too. Why? Because in order for us to rule over a kingdom of meshuggahness, we're going to have to also be meshuggah. But, this is the difference. We'll each put a little sign on our foreheads with a big mem. And only you and I will know it stands for meshuggah. So we at least will know that we are crazy. That's the story Rabbi Nachman says. The message is that's already a level. If a person can admit that the way he loses his temper many times, and that the way he improperly uses his love many times, if a person can at least recognize that he is, as we'll say, abyssal meshuga, then that's the beginning of tshuva. If you know you got a mem on your forehead, you got a chance. But the problem, Reb Nachman says, is that the way of the world is the opposite. That people look at the sign and they say, oh yeah, the other guy's crazy, but I'm normal. When the truth is, he's the crazy one. And this is what the Rebbe is saying. The Rebbe is saying, let's face it, we are all a little bit crazy. That's the first step that we have to realize. Take, for example, someone who is stuck in ego pride. Everything he does or says will activate some or many thoughts of ego pride. For example, how clever what I just said, or how nice what I just did, or how so-and-so will envy me, or everyone will talk about me and give me my due honor. Now, even if what he did or said was said or done in his own privacy, nevertheless, these thoughts will still be there. And after all is said and done, his actions may have been not only not clever, but even foolish. So is this the intelligent, rational being, and now prides himself in foolish action? And what kind of delusive thinking is it to weave up illusory conversations of others who have nothing to discuss because they did not see his actions? What's he thinking about me? What did they have to say? How come nobody gave me a Yashar Koyach today? The only explanation is that as far as his ego pride is concerned, this little area of Tiferes Nefula, he is psychotic. Now the Lashon that the Rebbe is in Hebrew is Mishuga Lo'oto Davar. He's crazy in this area. No matter how intelligent and genius he may be in all other manners. See, that's why he uses the term of calling them a sophisticated savant. Such is the case with ego pride. But the rational mind has similar delusions for self-indulgence, temper tantrums, or whatever. The Rebbe is laying down an incredible yesod that each and every one of us has to come to terms with. Each and every one of us is a meshuga la'oto davar in our life. And we have to learn to come to terms with that. And we're in good company. The meraglim were meshuga la'oto davar. Unbelievable tzaddikim. Unbelievable. Taking the lashes for other people. Could you ask more than that? When it came to ahava, unbelievable. But when it comes to kavod, that's where the meshugah lo'oto davar. The Jewish people as a whole have a lot of wonderful qualities. We went through a lot to trust Hashem. Lech teichach arei b'midbar b'eretz lo zaruah. We were trusting and we were believing in this. And wonderful people the Jewish people are. But when it came to ta'ava, when it came to lust, meshugah lo'oto davar. And Korach, with all the genius that he had, and Korach himself suffered much for the Jewish people. But when it came to Kina, Mishuga Lo'oto Davar. And that's why it's interesting, these three stories in Bamidbor, that are all clustered around together, really personify the statement of Chazal, that HaKina, the HaKavod, the HaGaitaiva, Ma'motzin Es Adam Min Olam. That these three things take a person out of the world. What does it mean it takes the person out of the world? So what the Mishnah means, when you become a Mishugah Lo'oto Davar, you could have everything else in a wonderful way. But this thing, you can't spot your fault. You're mamish nuts in this area only. Everywhere else, he's the nicest and sweetest guy. He's your best friend. What he wouldn't do to help another Jew? He can give tzedakah. He can be this. He can be a leader in the community. He's moser nefesh. But we all are human. And Hashem gave us, each and every one of us, at least one area to work in. that we are all Meshuga L'Oto Davar. And the Rebbe says, why don't we ever look at ourselves and wonder about it? That's Tisha B'Av. That's why we suffer. Because we all are Meshuga L'Oto Davar. Kamsa Bar Kamsa. Without going into great details. But the man who hosted the party must have been a pretty special fellow. All the rabbis went to him. He couldn't have been Stam a Schlepper. He must have been a very important community leader. All the Rabbanim were there. And if he made a Seudah, we know Rabbanim would not go to Seudahs that weren't the Seudahs Mitzvah. We know that. In those days, for sure, that time, they worry about political pressure. You know, whether the chairman of the board say, I have to go to this simcha, I go to that simcha. They only went to simchas that were really Seudahs Mitzvahs. You know the halachas in that. And like Mamash, all the Rabbanim were there. So it must have been a very worthwhile party. There must have been a million anim at this party. But one thing, he was Meshugal Oto Davar. For whatever reason, for whatever Kamsa did, whatever was the fight, whatever it was, we can theorize what the exact point was. If it was, you know, he wasn't forgiving, or this, or that, but he was a Meshugal Oto Davar in front of the whole world. And the guys was, I'll pay for the whole party, just don't be Mevayesh me. No, I can't have it. He throws them out in front of everybody. That's why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Because of a person's Meshuggah Lo Tov Davar, and then the fellow got thrown out, he became a Meshuggah Lo Tov Davar as well. And that's how the Beis HaMikdash gets destroyed. We need not elaborate greatly on how we find in our community many otherwise highly intelligent people that we all know and love, including ourselves, that have been acting and do act and will act Meshuga Lo Oto Davar. And you know when that happens a lot? When people all of a sudden make a simcha. Meshuga Lo Oto Davar. Meshuga. Crazy. The money that's being spent on simchas. Everybody has to come, invite the whole world. I said Shalom Aleichem to the guy in the supermarket yesterday. I'm going to invite him to the wedding. My theory on this is, I've been thinking a lot about this, and we talked about this a couple of years ago. My theory is, and not everybody's that way, but you can smell out a Meshuggah L'Oto Davar simcha. It's not hard, because things are so exaggerated. And there are people who maybe all their lives never really got to be in the spotlight. And they're regular people, but this is my occasion now. And it's going to be exactly the way I want it. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks, it's going to be exactly this way. And if you don't make sure to shake their hand the first when you come in, and then two times during, and to say it was the most amazing simcha. And when you leave, you got to shake their hand. And you got to call them up 2 weeks later to say it was the most amazing simcha. You're off their list. They don't want to talk to you. Or if you chas v'shalom, don't go to the wedding. What could be more important than the guy who I spoke to today for the first time, Shalom Aleichem, and he's not clearing his busy schedule to come to this wedding that will take about 27 hours from start to finish.